This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle a subject that we really haven't touched upon. It's a very, very important topic in integrative medicine. We're going to talk all about the scientific basis of acupuncture, and today we have an expert. She's Dr. Janet Mendes, who is an expert on the physiology behind acupuncture. She trained at the Rosenthal Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine at Columbia University. There's really a crucible for integrative medicine research in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And as Associate Director of Education and Training, she actually taught medical students and doctors in training about CAM, Complementary and Alternative Medicine. It seems that the theme of her professional life is to study and legitimize some of the practices that we sometimes think of as unscientific, but really they are. She is currently associated with the Tri-State School of Traditional Chinese Medicine, TCM, which is actually a place that I studied at way back when, eons ago, during the 20th century, when I was a medical student. I spent some time studying acupuncture and traditional Chinese medical practices, including herbal medicine. And now she's there conducting research and educating students about how acupuncture might work. So, first of all, I also want to mention that she is my editor in a great new book that's come out, Integrative Sexual Health. She, along with Barbara Bartlick and Dr. Gio Espinosa, they have been the editors of this wonderful compendium that's part of the WIL series on integrative medicine, focusing on sexual health. And so, first, before we get into acupuncture, tell us a little bit about integrative sexual health.
Thanks very much, Dr. Hoffman. I do want to correct a couple of things you said about me, but I'll hold that for a minute. I'll respond to your request to say something about integrative sexual health. Yes, I and Drs. Bartlick and Espinosa were the co-editors. We also co-authored some of the chapters. You are an author of one of the chapters, along with Ms. Leila Mueden from your office. And we also happen to have, since we're talking today about Chinese medicine, there is a chapter even in our book about Chinese medicine used for men's health concerns. So this book came about because my two co-editors and authors, Drs. Bartlick and Espinosa, are both sexuality experts, and both have been involved throughout their careers with integrative medicine and how it may be of benefit in men's health, women's health, also in psychiatry and urology, their respective specialties. And I personally am not a sexual expert. I want to make that clear. I'm now a growing expert in integrative medicine research, and I have experimental training, and that is research training. And also, I was sort of the primary editor, science person on this book. So together, we made a very strong team, and we realized some years ago this is a neglected area. And as Dr. Weil says in his foreword, Dr. Andrew Weil, whose integrative medicine series this is part of, as you mentioned, for Oxford University Press, Dr. Weil said, no, this is an area that physicians get almost no training during their 4 years and after in residency. If you don't become a specialist in sexual medicine, you know almost nothing what you could offer patients except to refer them to a specialist. And today we recognize that many of the limited in this area, sexual medicine, limited pharmaceuticals, limited procedures, whatever devices that might be available for certain sexual problems, you know, they don't really address the picture well enough. And most doctors, again, know too little about integrative medicine. So we saw a really big need for this book. And as we put it together, our sense that we were on the right track really, you know, deepened a great deal. So I could say more about the book. Maybe you'd like to comment a bit about it, about your chapter. But we're very pleased with it. We hope that it will reach many providers, that it will influence them in their practice, give them new tools and new resources, especially put sexuality into the context of integrative medicine. Many sexual problems spring from people's poor lifestyle habits, poor nutrition, not enough exercise. I'm not saying every sexual problem can be healed by people becoming healthy in general, but often that can help a great deal. And there are many solutions that are evidence-based. There's a ton of research cited in this book. We feel it's a great new resource for people addressing anything in that area.
And this is such a pervasive problem. And, you know, we tend to think of this as an elder problem. You know, as you get older, sexuality wanes. But actually, a big story in a British newspaper, The Mirror, it's kind of a clickbait tabloid story, but it does illustrate the point. Headline, men in their 30s hit by impotence epidemic as half suffer from erectile dysfunction. Tagline on that is, surprise polling reveals this age group is most likely to struggle keeping it up, with 49% blaming stress, 24% blaming boozing too much, and yes, lifestyle is a big factor. You know, I think human sexuality is part of our portfolio of optimal performance and health, and it's also a reflection of one's general underlying health, and that's why when Task was writing a chapter on the relationship between diet and sexuality, we really looked at the research and we found that, you know, there are certain facts about diet that related to sexual performance. So,
absolutely.
So your chapters, you co-wrote some chapters in the book, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. With Drs. Bartlick and Falk on a chapter mostly about the whole gut-brain axis and how this underlies mental health, mood. Obviously, one's mood state is very related often to one's either sexual interest, sexual performance, you know, other aspects of one's psychology and one's daily life that could influence one's interest in sex or one's relationship to others around one that have a lot of implications for intimacy. So we co-authored that chapter. And then with Dr. Bartlick and Dr. Sheila Haas, there's a chapter, a very useful chapter that really goes to another major point about sexuality and modern life, chapter about how all kinds of micronutrient deficiencies can be caused by medications that people take, medications that they may need for their health, but maybe with better lifestyle and diet and some attention to these micronutrient deficiencies, which, you know, these depletions happen over time, taking a medication for a while. But these are very real phenomena supported by research. We put all that together in one chapter, and it's very, very compelling. And then a lot of those micronutrient deficiencies have sometimes direct or indirect or by several pathways an impact on sexual performance and the ability to feel desire and so on. So we tried to couch this whole sphere in this domain of people have to realize that their vitality undergirded by a healthy lifestyle and attention to things such as the impact of medications they take, you know, all of this has to be looked at more comprehensively and in a more integrated manner to help resolve some of these problems. And just one last point on that, as you pointed out, these kinds of distressing problems, even if they're, you know, not like many medical conditions immediately linked to some life-threatening disease, we now understand from many sources and Dr. Gio Espinoza's, some of his chapters and also a chapter by Dr. Lam of NYU points out that the obesity epidemic is now also a big part of problems for men. And I assume women
and
also.
That might be at play in the younger individuals who suffer from ED, and then among women, Fertility problems are rampant. So, exactly. You know, we're seeing, I mean, I think there was some very, very dramatic statistic about how we're going in reverse in terms of fertility in this country. The only group in the U.S. that's experiencing an increase in fertility, interestingly, is the 40 plus age group. And a lot of that's through assisted reproductive technology. Mm-hmm. We're less fertile. Some of it may be due to choice, you know, waiting too long, but some of it may be due to pollutants and diet and stress. And, you know, that's a whole realm in and of itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, citing one more, you know, you keep raising these topics that we actually do address directly in the book, as you are aware. There's a chapter on environmental contaminants, chemicals in the environment that affect our bodies and that really are incontrovertibly affecting things such as fertility. These are called estrogen disruptors, and many chemicals that we routinely are exposed to may have an estrogenic effect, not just on women, but also on men, and they can be responsible for fertility issues, feminization in men, especially if these are lifelong exposures starting when people are very young. They're reputed perhaps to be involved with weight gain. Many different chemical processes in the body could be affected by these sources of pollution and environmental contaminants.
Indeed. Well, so let's switch gears and let's talk a little bit about acupuncture. You know, acupuncture, we're steeped in the world of integrative medicine, but to keep perspective on this, there are actually naysayers out there who say that acupuncture is bunk, that it's basically a big placebo effect, and, it doesn't do much good.
Right.
Your take on that critique?
Well, again, I want to say first to your audience, I am no expert on Chinese medicine per se. My expertise is that I was trained in research, as you point out, and after getting my PhD years ago at NYU in a research area of psychology, and then segueing more into neuroscience as that developed, and then eventually coming to Columbia University Medical Center and the Rosenthal Center in the late 90s, I did have years then of exposure to NIH-funded research there and other projects we initiated with many different faculty. So this is to establish my bona fides as a researcher, well-trained in understanding the nature of research and what it shows and what it doesn't show.
But that's good in a way, because it's not like you have skin in the game. You are an objective researcher. You're dedicated to very high standards of scientific veracity. And I think you're going to call it as you see it, you know, when it comes to rigorous, research findings.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I certainly hope I'll always hold to that standard. I intend to. That's my training and my ethic. And I have to say that there are people who come to train in Chinese medicine who, you know, are very dedicated. The students that I've encountered are people from, I just want to say a few things about who comes in our modern world in America, who comes to study acupuncture out of a conviction that it can really help people. I'll get to what the evidence shows in a minute, but these are people often who have some other kind of integrative medicine training. They might be a massage therapist or a physiotherapist of some kind, or they might have some other kind of integrative medicine involvement. They're all ages, all ethnicities and backgrounds, a very diverse place. It's the Tri-State College of Acupuncture today, by the way. It had a different name when you studied there.
Right.
And it's here in New York City, and the other main school is the Pacific College here in New York City. And of course, around the country, there are a number of schools, and anyone interested in looking into training can always avail themselves of the ACAOM website. That's the accrediting council for all these schools of acupuncture. So I do want to make the point to your listeners that all of these schools are highly regulated. This is not just somebody deciding to start a little school somewhere and train people in these interesting ancient Chinese or Asian methods. They are all accredited the way modern schools of any kind, universities, medical schools, and so on, have to be evaluated and accredited. There are certain standards for the master's, which leads to master's in acupuncture, which leads to licensure as an LAC or a licensed acupuncturist. And these standards are very high in my experience. And so as someone who's experienced academic standards, not just at NYU, but at Harvard, where I did my undergraduate work years ago, so and at Columbia for years, so I'm impressed with what I see in the field that way. So who are these people? Again, all ages and backgrounds. They might be career changers, people who started careers in areas usually not to do with medicine, And also, there are often people who come to this field because they or someone they know was greatly helped by acupuncture and Chinese medicine, where Western medicine somehow failed them or did not have something to offer for the condition that they had. So that's a story you frequently hear at the school. It's very striking to me. So these are all hardworking people. It's a really rigorous program. They give up a lot for 3 years to train and get tremendous amount of hands-on exposure at the Tri-State School. And now I've been hired. There was a minimal course in acupuncture research methods before, but you know, it takes a certain combination of expertise to plunge into the area that I am in, and the director of the school, I guess, realized that I would be a good addition to their faculty because I have so much research background, and yet I also have been involved with integrative medicine research. So now what I do is I'm the person instructing the acupuncture students on what we know about the evidence, about clinical research evidence, basic science, qualitative research. There's an explosion of literature in all of these areas. And I have to say, some of the acupuncture students are not thrilled to have to be learning this because they feel...
Right. We're preaching to the choir already, and they were sold at hello.
That's right. They were sold, and, you know, they believe in the clinical benefits. That's, you know, a good thing that keeps them involved, but they have to recognize that many of them will need to be working in hospitals with doctors. Increasingly, the worlds are mixing. Yeah. They have to be able to explain this kind of thing to
They have to be proper emissaries of the field,
right.
I think, and represent the field as a scientific endeavor that's acceptable within a conventional medical setting. And, you know, that's just the reality of it.
Yes, that's the reality. Some are much more interested than others. Some really, they not just understand why they have to learn this, but they embrace it. Others, you know, are more recalcitrant. But I think that all of them wind up learning a lot from these courses that helps them. And that's not least because, to me, as someone now really steeping myself in this research literature, to me, studying acupuncture really raises many fascinating questions for Western medicine, as well as being the path to justifying acupuncture to the wider medical world and saying why it should be used and whether it should be reimbursed by insurance and when it should be a go-to option. So it raises many fascinating questions, especially when you get into the basic science research literature. How does it work? Why does it work? So we'll touch on all of that.
Well, so pretend I'm a very skeptical chief of internal medicine at a traditional hospital.
Right.
And, you know, as they say, convince me I'm from Missouri, you know?
Okay. Well, that's the show me state, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Their state motto. I'll start with an article, actually, that's in what we call qualitative research. It was written, actually, by one of the faculty at the Tri-State School and some colleagues, Dr. Basha Kilchinska, who's herself a licensed acupuncturist and an MD, and she was part of a whole group at Beth Israel Medical Center before it got converted into part of Mount Sinai, she and her colleagues were studying the acceptability of acupuncture on an inpatient service in a hospital, I presume possibly at Beth Israel years ago, but I don't know for sure. They didn't identify the hospital in their paper.
They did a lot of addiction management, I believe, at Beth Israel. There was a traditional department within BI, and
I see.
Possibly they may have utilized acupuncture adjunctively. I'm not sure.
Well, actually, her paper doesn't touch on addiction management. It's true. I'll say a little more about that later. It's true that one of the famous uses of acupuncture actually initiated here in New York, I believe, by Dr. Michael Smith.
Yep.
I'm not certain about that.
Lincoln Hospital, right here.
Exactly.
Harlem.
Exactly. He pioneered this so-called NADA protocol. I forget what NADA stands for, but some of you may be aware that acupuncture, there's the whole concept in Chinese medicine of the meridians, which basically diagram a kind of energy flow in the body. A little more about all that later. And along the meridians are many acupuncture points. We could call them canonical points. They're points identified in traditional Chinese medicine going back hundreds, thousands of years. Sometimes there are other points, special points, or other points that are not on the meridians. And there are also areas of the body that are considered to be a kind of micro-acupuncture locus. And the ear, the whole outer ear structure is considered such a locus. And the NADA protocol involves needling a special pattern of points in the outer ear. There are other protocols that focus only on this so-called auricular acupuncture. And that NADA protocol was seen to be quite effective in helping patients with various addictions. A lot of the ear acupuncture can be kind of stress-reducing. And modern science tells us that one reason why that is so, and there are other protocols, for example, there's a so-called battlefield acupuncture protocol, mm-hmm. needling only the auricle or the outer ear, and it's used by the military today, by the way, and in fact, the VA has been mandating having acupuncturists in their hospitals. This is all taken quite seriously by the military. These protocols, if you especially needle points more in the inner part of the outer ear, what's called the concha, sort of the little funnelly part heading into the head and the brain, that area stimulates, upregulates the vagus nerve, one of yes. our most powerful mm-hmm. Neural systems in the body, which then increases our parasympathetic nervous system activity. And this has a calming effect. Mm-hmm. So it works for that reason.
Yeah, it's sort of the anti-fight-or-flight reflex.
That's absolutely right. You know, it sort of calms the sympathetic nervous system, which is underpinning the whole arousal fight-or-flight mechanism, and upregulates these parasympathetics called rest and digest, or the Madonna reflex, various terms. But basically, it's a relaxation counterpoint to the high arousal, mobilize the muscles and the aggression and so on pattern of human behavior. And acupuncture directly stimulates the vagus nerve. In this, it's a little bit like some kinds of brain stimulation about which we can talk later. Mm-hmm. So let's see, the paper that I started out mentioning, Dr. Kilchinska's paper with others, what they did was they brought some acupuncture trainees or recent grads into a regular medical service. I forget, it might have been a surgical service of some kind. And they wanted to see how well it would be accepted. This falls under qualitative research because they weren't investigating, is acupuncture good to heal a certain medical problem? That would be a clinical study of some kind. And they weren't investigating a basic science question about what's a mechanism of action of acupuncture, what does it do, and how does it do it. They were looking at the larger social context, the larger medical world context, and basically you get data from those kinds of situations through interviews and questionnaires and so on. And in brief, what they found was that when doctors saw that when their patients who were agitated and upset, either they had a medical issue or they were about to have a surgery or something, and the acupuncturists would treat them before they had to go for a procedure, and they were then much calmer and were able to deal with the procedure better, maybe they had less pain, things were working more smoothly. So doctors who had no knowledge of acupuncture and might be still quite skeptical about it were nonetheless impressed that their patients' emotional and a kind of behavioral status could be quickly shifted into a much more calm or more pain-free status, allowing them to proceed with the next step in their treatment, possibly a surgery or some other intervention that was problematic or, you know, hard to get them to, be on board for or tolerate in some way at that point. So, you as the chief of this, the skeptical chief of this unit, you might say to yourself, I don't have to accept everything that might be said about acupuncture, mm-hmm. but I see from research like that, that it does some good in terms of pragmatic clinical behaviors, things relevant to my service, so I might be willing to try it. And this is often you could say it's a kind of gateway exposure, not a drug, but, gateway exposure. And sometimes medical people who are highly skeptical, they are involved with some episode like that, and then they're willing to be a little more open-minded. I want to mention in that context that we've started a little bit of a mini program at the Tri-State School. I personally have started where we invite medical students. We now have med students from some of our medical schools, fourth-year students who do an elective, and they choose to do an elective in integrative medicine. And we now invite small groups of them at a time, and also pre-meds and residents, to come to the school for a couple of weeks. It's a free program that we offer on a restricted basis. We have limited room for people and limited manpower for this, but we really want future doctors to have an exposure that will help them keep an open mind about acupuncture.
At the very least, to familiarize them with it as an option.
Yes.
They don't necessarily have to embrace it, become, trained acupuncturists, with full buy-in. But at the very least, they need to know that it has a place in the constellation of medical modalities that are at their disposal. And I think that's a big advance, at least that it has been introduced. This is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts. And we've laid the groundwork for our discussion of acupuncture with today's guest. She's Dr. Janet Mindes. And
they're all correct.
Yeah, you're used to this, I'm sure.
I am.
And, her background is in research, but she's been intensely involved in studying acupuncture and teaching acupuncture students and medical students and young physicians about complementary and alternative medicine from a scientific perspective. In part two, we're going to continue our deep dive into what acupuncture is, how it might work, what it's good for, perhaps what it's not. And also, we're going to touch upon a related modality. Related not in the sense that it involves needles, but in that it works on the brain. It's called TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. It so happens that Dr. Mindes initiated and is co-investigator on a study using TMS. And we'll find out more about that. So stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.